This podcast is produced by Unedited.
My name's Louise Golby. I'm an independent artist and I've been writing and performing my own music for quite a while now. As a songwriter myself, I'm very interested in the art of songwriting, how song ideas come about, what triggers certain lyrics, or how a melody or musical idea is started. In this series, I've interviewed some of the UK's leading songwriters and artists, discussing their songwriting techniques and stories behind their biggest songs and collaborations. My guests have written tracks for the likes of Stevie Wonder, Tina Turner and Cher, as well as receiving MBEs, Grammys, Ivor Novello's and number one singles for their work. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the first series of our podcast as much as I have making it, and I hope it's given you an opportunity to discover more of their music through my specially curated playlists. I feel like a temptress. My guest is a Grammy and Ivor Novello award-winning songwriter, composer and producer who's responsible for one of the most played and performed songs of the last decade. He started out as lead guitarist in 1970s glam rock band Mud. He then went on to be one of the most in-demand and successful songwriters in the UK. He's worked alongside DJ Paul Oakenfold, Enrique Iglesias, Sophie Ellis-Bextor, Holly Valance, Blue, Mika, Rachel Stevens and Danny Minogue, to name a few. In the early 2000s, he was behind three huge number one songs. I am absolutely thrilled to have had the chance to interview Rob Davis about his successful songwriting career, artists he's worked with, and stories behind some of his biggest songs. I opened with a question I've been asking all of my guests. If I was to introduce you with just one song, what would it be?
It was my second day of working with Cathy Dennis. It was over a weekend. We did one song the day before, and the inspiration wasn't unnecessary anything really. We just knew it had to be a certain tempo, sort of a dance vibe really, before we started. So I had like a groove up before the song happened, but and we just wrote it in sections. It's like a weird one. She had Can't Get It In My Head, the actual melody line in her head on the way to the studio, she said. And I was playing around with acoustic on D minor over a drum loop, and then I come up with a lah thing, and then started putting keyboards on. There wasn't a track, all there was drums. We were just doing it in pieces, as we, just in sections over a couple of hours, you know. And the song was finished and demoed in 7 hours at my old shed.
Oh, wow.
And when one of my publishers first heard it, he said, "There's no chorus." I said, "Yes, there is. It starts with it, you know." And this is the reaction of that song, because it's an unusual structure. But I think some songs, if they aren't a logical structure, like verse, bridge, chorus, some they can be great. And even some old songs are like that, where you just hear a hook going round and round and the verses are the same as the chorus.
That's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it, because the la 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 bit is like a hook, but it's not necessarily the chorus.
No. And it just moves out in unusual spaces. I think that's probably half the magic, because it was different.
I actually, when I first started gigging, I was doing jazz gigs with a pianist, and we did a swing version of Can't Get You Out of My Head, and it actually worked really well, because I just can't get you out of my head. You kind of swing it.
There was a cover version by a known jazz, and they sung I Could Just Can't Get You Out of My Bed.
Oh.
Yes, it gets covers. In fact, there's a cover last week came through with the guy singing it, Low.
So had you been put together with Cathy Dennis then by a label, or did you know her previously?
Yeah, Simon Fuller wanted us to work together, like a little bit before. You know, I think he got my profile, did Groove Jet and Toxic Miracle and stuff like that, and he wanted us to hook up, yeah.
Is it true that the song wasn't originally for Kylie?
We just, once we'd had done it, I think Fuller played it to the band he had signed. I've forgotten their name, but I know Sophie Ellis-Bextor had turned it down, and I think she regrets that since those days.
Because obviously you'd worked with her on Groove Jet. Was it S Club 7? I think I read.
I think they thought it wasn't suitable. You know.
Yeah, I can't imagine them doing it. But obviously now we know it's Kylie's song. It's kind of I can't imagine anyone else doing it. And do you think I mean, the song's so good. Do you think it wouldn't have mattered who sung it? It would have still been a hit? Or do you feel like with Kylie, and it was a big comeback song, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think she did stamp her thing on it, and the video was amazing as well. So that sort of sold it really well, I think, you know. And I think the song was very different for the time. It sort of captured a pop audience and a dance audience, and it had a sort of a credible club vibe as well. You know, that's where we scored, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So with the lyric, I presume then, because you said that Kathy Dennis on the way to the studio couldn't get the melody out of her head, was that literally what that...
Just that line she had, it's the only thing we had to start off on the drum loop and the chords. And everything was developed in pieces. Like we'd go, oh, we like that, and we like that change, and just wrote the vocals as we went together, you know. It's just one of those things. And normally, quite often you have a whole backing track before you even do a top line, but this was like just a different thing completely, you know.
A different way of writing. And was it, so it was different to how you normally would write songs?
No, I've written for so long, I do everything different. everything varies. If I know I've got a singer coming that's in a dance vibe, I'll do some backing tracks, but I won't make them, you know, definite. I'll pull them around once the singer's there, or change bits, but... Yeah, there's no rules, really.
Could you have predicted how big that song was going to be? Like, you obviously knew it was going to be good, but...
No way. I mean, the label was a guy called Jamie Nelson at Parlophone was totally into that from day one, and he said it's going to be a smash. And then a few months later, I heard Kylie do it live before she'd even recorded it, and that was like, wow, it's really good, you know.
The song went to number one in 25 countries, is that right? Every European country except one. And it earned you both, you and Kathy Dennis, 3 Ivor Novello Awards. For you, you've had obviously other massive hits, but that one is the one that sticks out.
Yes, yeah, spot on, yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to ask a bit more about the beginning, how you got into songwriting. Obviously, we'll talk about Mud, but I just wondered what your, you know, the first song you wrote, your journey as a writer, when you knew you could... write songs.
Just even before the Mud days, I had a little bit of a passion for writing songs, and used to do stuff on a Revox in those days, and wrote Mud B-sides initially, and it's just something I've always loved and been a part of me, really, you know. But I think you've got to love it and go through the misses and have the bad times through it and just learn by it all. And if you still love it and you stay with it, then I think you've got a better chance of getting somewhere, you know.
So obviously you were in the band Mud, which was a glam rock 70s band. Well, you started in the late 60s, and most people know Tiger Feet, but also one of the songs that you wrote for Mud, which was Lilla Lucy. Was it a collaborative effort in the band with the songs, or?
Me and the bass player at one point, I mean, we're the only two left in the band now. The bass player, we lived next door to each other for quite a while. We had like a studio combined to the backs of our houses, and we wrote that together and a couple of other Mud things, yeah.
And you wrote, I read that you wrote over 45 songs for the band.
Yeah, but probably more than that. They didn't make it.
Some didn't make it. And do you miss the performing side of things, or, you know, were you quite happy when the band finished and you became more behind the scenes?
No, I still love the live side. I mean, the last about 4 or 5 years, the bass player said to me, do you want to do some Mud gigs? And we started doing them again, just because for the fun of it. And I've always enjoyed, because I'm a guitar player, I've always enjoyed a jam session in pubs and doing all sorts of things live. So I think it's another way of getting a buzz and gets you away from the studio, because you spend so many hours doing the studio. It's good to do some live things, you know.
Definitely. So did you have concerts or gigs planned that have now been cancelled because of lockdown, or?
Yeah, we had a couple in Europe, yeah, over the summer, yeah. Yeah. So we lost that, but never mind.
Oh, hopefully they'll be rescheduled. At least we can write and record from home, so.
Yes. My other passion is yoga, so you can get lots of online yoga classes.
Yeah, exactly. There's lots online. It's good. I'm trying to keep fit as well. So are you ever put in the room with the artist when you're booked, you know, to write for a particular artist, or is it often pitching for an artist without actually being in the room with them?
It's mostly without them, but the odd occasion, recently I've written a few things with Karen Hardin, and she's like a really good writer. She's a lovely girl and easy to write with, yeah.
Okay, great. So when you're writing for, say, like female vocalists, you have to think about the key and their range and everything like that before you kind of start?
Yeah, it's surprising. Some singers have got a really good range and they can sort of plop something anywhere, but it's good to think about what the range is, yeah. sometimes you'll finish a song and like she'll go or my co-writer will go, oh, I'd sing this much better higher so I can shove it up a few key, you know, a few tones or whatever, you know. So it's, the technology is so phenomenal nowadays, it's very easy to change keys and stuff.
That's true. So do you always get a demo done then for like a female singer to do the demo for whoever it is?
Yeah, I always get a demo, and you find now, I mean, all writers say it, that the demo's got to sound like a record now.
Absolutely, yeah, because it almost feels like the labels just they don't have the imagination to be like, oh, if this was produced more or whatever, you kind of just have to show it exactly how it would be. So do you think you know what the magic hit ingredient is? Sorry, the magic ingredient for a hit.
I think as you get older and the longer you've been in the business, I think your ears are better. Sometimes I used to think the latest thing was the best thing I've ever done. Every time the new thing was the best. But now I think you get so experienced, you think, oh, that, and you listen to something you did a year ago and you think, oh, that doesn't make it, or that's better than it could be, and, you know, it's worth updating some old songs. But I think your ears do get better.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you kind of keep in touch with what's like in the top 10 whenever you're writing with new people?
Definitely. I'm totally into dance music as well, so I'm always listening to club stuff, even left of centre sort of club stuff, because the most unusual things happen nowadays, you know.
Oh yeah, because you obviously worked with Paul Oakenfold, didn't you? Do you still work with him, or was
no,
that kind
Paul
of
lives
time?
In LA now, but I, yeah, still speak, and he's he's doing music for games and stuff. I think he's still DJs. I don't know if he's putting much stuff out, but it's not over with Paul, which was a biggie.
Yeah, it's not over yet, because then the Claxons redid that one, didn't they? And that was a big hit again. Did you know, back to your other hits, which actually around 2000, 2001 was when you had the three big number ones, Tucker's Miracle, Groove Jet,
yeah,
and Can't Get You Out of My Head. And Groove Jet, obviously, kind of started Sophie Ellis Bex's career off, really, because it was her first single, wasn't it, or the first
number one? Yeah, I think Murder on the Dance Floor, was that after? Yeah, it was after, wasn't it? Yeah.
So do you think your songwriting approach then has changed since the beginning of the of your career?
Yeah, very, very much. And I find as I do it more, like I said earlier, the demos have to be better. I think initially, earlier on, my production wasn't great, and I just it was always the song that counted. But I think it's just as much the demo as the song now, and especially in dance, sometimes it's a big riff that makes the song and not necessarily the vocal. So everything has to be spot on now.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a bit about your collaborations, because obviously we've talked about Kathy Dennis, but you've also written with Lamont Dozier, Egg White, who did Think I Better Leave Right Now, Wayne Hector, Steve Mack, Marcella Detroit, and obviously Kathy Dennis. So I just want to know about, you know, how it is when you're co-writing. Do you ever get put in a session and nothing comes, or is it always productive?
I think mostly something always comes, and sometimes it's surprisingly quick, and I found that over the last few years you get something quite easy, because I mean, if you collaborate with someone who's got a good voice, is for me is really important as well, that I don't have to finish the song and then get another singer on it. It's better if like Wayne's got a brilliant voice, Egg's got a brilliant voice, Kathy's got a brilliant voice as well, so you know you're going to get a great vocal down as you're doing the song.
Yeah. So which songs would we know of that you've written with Wayne Hector and Egg White?
None. I think I've had something released with Wayne, but I've certainly had something released with Steve Mack that was a hit in Australia, but way back. But the other two, yeah, I think it's just been for pitches, you know.
It's actually, so all of my guests so far seem to be connected. So we had Michelle Escoffrey as our first guest, and she was one of the original stock writers at EMI with Kathy Dennis. There was only two female writers and she was one. She wrote Just a Little, yep, and she also knew Wayne Hector and Steve Mack and Ali Tennant. But also we've interviewed Omar, but he's worked with Lamont Dozier, so everyone's connected.
Oh, I love Omar, but I've never worked with him.
So, sorry, back to collaborating, though. Do you normally feel like you have to or one of you has to come in with an idea, or do you always write from scratch? I guess it depends on the artist, right?
Well, I found on this lockdown thing, I like to work with a singer who's got a studio, and I've been writing a couple of things with a girl where I've been sending her tracks and got some really good results like that. If you know the girl's got a good voice, she can put it down and write the whole vocal, or I'll send her a vocal idea and she'll develop it a little bit more. But so, I mean, it is nice to sit with each other and go through it and piece it together, but sometimes you can still get a bit of magic if you've got a track and it inspires somewhere else, you know.
Have you ever been put in a writing session and either haven't gelled with the writer, if it's someone you haven't worked with before, or it's just nothing's come that day, there's no inspiration, or
just the odd things, not for a long time, the odd things that it hasn't happened, yeah, but nothing that comes to memory, really.
Have you ever been influenced by what's around you politically or socially when you're writing lyrics?
Do you know what? One of my favourite things to do lyrically is what the Bee Gees used to do, is if I get to like a station and I'm waiting for a train and there's half an hour to spend, I'll go into Smith's and look for all different books and just look for loads of subtitles. And I think, especially for the dance thing, if you start with a good lyric for a chorus, it's got to be simple, but it's got to be different if you can get it. So I work like that. I keep zillions of just little lines and ideas in my phone or in a book. I'm sure a lot of singers do that, I'm sure.
When you wrote Tocca's Miracle,
yes,
the original lyrics, what was that about?
I saw it in a political book on a bookshelf, I Need a Miracle, and I thought, wow, I'm going to use that. On that sort of situation, I wrote this whole top line on that. I think I just wrote words around that just applied for that situation. It wasn't political or anything. It's almost like, I don't know, a sophisticated love idea, you know?
I love it because it's such a powerful lyric. So the Groove Jet, If This Ain't Love, do you remember the lyric idea behind that? Or
well, that's a long one. My publisher at the time, Universal, she gave me that backing track. So I was only involved in the vocal on that, and I wrote the chorus on that. And I think I wrote a whole song, and they just used the chorus. And I think maybe Sophie wrote the verses, and I wrote my bit, and that was just pieced together. So yeah, it was a big sample on that, which I remember at the time of saying I'll replay that guitar, but I think it lost half the publishing on that. But never mind.
So tell us what song you're most proud of as a songwriter. So it doesn't have to be your most commercial song, but the song that you feel musically or lyrically is your like best work.
I think I quite like, we had a song called Shake It Down in Mud, which still sounds good. You know, that was a hit, but it changes every day.
Are people quite surprised when they hear that you wrote stuff for Kylie, but you were also in a glam rock band? Do people kind of find the connection quite odd? Or
yeah, everybody does. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I think it's my musical influence from the 70s. I was quite into the Isley Brothers, Steely Dan, and people like that. In the 80s, I did a few dance things, and I did an album with a guy called Oliver Cheatham, which was more soul, you know. So,
oh yeah, I love Oliver Cheatham.
Yeah, he had an amazing voice.
Yeah, yeah. What was the big dance hit that got re
Saturday Night?
Yeah,
got re. It was Room 5, I think it was called, wasn't it?
That's great. Okay, so I just want to talk to you about your accolades, because obviously you've got the 3 Ivor Novellos for Can't Get You Out of My Head, and you've had Brit nominations, ARIAs, which is at the Australian Awards, and a Grammy, yes, which was for a Kylie song.
Come Into My World, yeah.
So tell us what these mean to you and your family and how you felt at the time.
What the Grammy has got an amazing experience to it. I remember being invited to it that day, and it was incredible. The opening act was Prince and Beyonce. This 2004, Like, the whole live thing was absolutely mind-blowing that year. All my favourite acts on, and Justin Timberlake and Earth, Wind & Fire live. It was like an unbelievable show, you know. Probably the best gig I've ever been to. And two of my favourite producers from the 80s were Jam and Lewis, and they presented the Grammy to us, you know, which was amazing.
Oh, wow. Do you get a tip-off that you've won? Or?
Yeah, we knew before the show, yeah, definitely.
But I presume you would have wanted to have gone anyway.
Oh, yeah.
I think
I think at the time I was actually doing a riot at the time, so I was over there. One of the other writers I did a few things was Greg Alexander. Do you remember? He did a lot of big records. I did an Enrique album with him. Did three
That's
tracks
right.
on
so
that.
Which Enrique songs was it that you wrote with him?
It was album tracks. They weren't hits, but yeah, you know, we made a few album tracks. But it was a lovely experience. It was like pretty mad being with an Enrique in Miami. He took us on these mad boat rides and tried to throw us off the boat and all that, you know.
Amazing. So tell us a bit more about Greg Alexander and why it was so special working with him.
Well, he phoned me out of the blue, and he had quite a few big hits by then. And he said, do you want to work on an Enrique album? And Greg is completely mad. And it was just an unusual situation. I got invited to Miami. We're in the top of this hotel. There was a lovely studio. And there's all sorts of stories. Greg and Enrique had lots of battles, and it was hilarious. And we'd be riding away, and all of a sudden there was things like some tramps heard us downstairs, because the music was quite loud and they had the window open. And they're going to the guys, send us some money for some pizzas. And Greg and Enrique were throwing $100 bills down there, you know, so it was hilarious. Because they were getting that every day then. It was hilarious.
Nice.
Yeah.
I bet that they missed that era.
Yeah, it was fun. And Enrique was always trying to do something mad, you know, getting me on the back of a motorbike and throw me off it and stuff like that. You know, it's like completely bonkers. He would throw us off the back of a boat, you know. Yeah, but Enrique was hilarious. Do some mad things. One day he smashed an acoustic guitar up in the booth, and the engineer sort of taped it, the strings bang, while he was swearing, and put it across the keyboard. It was hilarious.
Did he do it out of anger or for fun?
Yeah, I think it was half jokey, but it was an old, battered old thing anyway. But it was...
Oh, okay. So not that rock and roll, but quite rock and roll.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the changes in the music industry? So with technology and streaming, how do you feel about it? And has it changed your approach to the songwriting? Obviously, you've said about the production being, you know, half the standard of it. But what about...
Well, I think we all know as musicians and writers that the streaming thing has like cut our income, you know, so much. And Spotify and all that, hardly pay anything. But I think you've just got to use this streaming stuff to bring it further and get as much out as you can and hope it crosses and becomes a hit.
And obviously, I mean, I mentioned to Michelle that because of streaming, people don't necessarily listen to an album in the order that you wanted it to be. So does that make every song on the album more important because you want people might be listening to it sporadically?
Yeah, I think so. And I think... most people who do use Spotify and probably don't listen to the whole album. They probably pick tunes off different albums that they like, you know, and unless you're an avid fan of somebody, you know. But I think nowadays maybe album tracks are a little bit lower in stature than the single. Like when you hear like Rumours or a Steely Dan album from the old, every track was mind-blowing, and it's hard to get that nowadays.
Yeah, but I'm you know, we like to think that people do still listen to whole albums. Mm-hmm. In the order.
Yeah.
Because I know when I'm trying to decide, you know, an order of an EP or an album, mm-hmm. I spend ages overthinking it.
Yes.
And maybe it doesn't matter, but...
It's like, I think you can, when you're mixing a song or something, I use this method. If I mix something in this room and it sounds good, and I think, right, this is good, and then I'll play it next day in the car in a different environment because it's got quite a decent sound system, and I always spot something wrong with a mix, which I wouldn't have done if I was staying in the same room, you know.
That's a good point, actually. And I think as well, from production, things have to be mastered for different things now, don't they? So like a radio master would be different to a stream one or a CD or a vinyl.
Yeah.
So there's a lot
complex. But I think everybody's mastering for streaming nowadays, aren't they, really?
Yeah, I think that's unfortunately the priority, isn't
Unless
it?
Unless you're going, but, no, it's going straight to radio, which is different.
Yeah. So I guess you must still get a lot of radio play for all your big hits. So
yeah, and Syncs as well, which is
yeah.
good. Yeah, yeah. It's great for Syncs.
Yeah, Syncs, another thing that people obviously...
Yeah,
is so where the money is in.
Yeah, so much competition now though for if there's a sync available, because quite often they just pick an old song.
Well, but I guess you get people approach you for songs that you've already written, so it's.
Oh yeah, my publisher. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's all right then. Do you ever write pitches for sync?
Oh, what sync to movie sort of thing?
No, as in. If you get given a brief, do you ever write specifically for like a TV show or a film, or do you just...
No, not really. If I get a song, in fact, I've got something I wrote with a girl a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, wow, this could be really good for Netflix, and I sent it to Universal, and they really like it, but they said Netflix have stopped now for a couple of months,
Oh, well, as in there's no production?
Yeah,
I know. I know, they need to try and find a way of making TV programmes without... needing a crew somehow.
Yeah, do it on Zoom.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently Neighbours back to Kylie again.
Yeah, yeah.
But apparently Neighbours are trying to film virtually and then have CGI crowds and stuff. I don't know how it's going to work, but
wow.
I just actually, before we go to our final question, did you want to mention anything that you're working on at the moment? Because obviously you're working on new stuff, so you've got a couple of projects.
I work with a girl writer called Kileza, and she's really brilliant, and I'm getting a couple of things out with her, but I'll keep you in line, let you know on that, whatever comes of it. Oh, and also I've done an album, an ambient album called Chill Tracks, and it's sort of linked, because I'm into yoga, it's linked to the track chakras in yoga, but it's electronic and it's quite cutting edge, and there's no vocals, completely instrumentals. Years ago in the 70s, when we were first doing lots of big gigs, I used to get stressed out staying in digs and trying to get away from the music thing and the drugs and the booze. And I met someone in a band with a yoga magazine, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. And I started looking at it and taking some classes just to take my brain somewhere else, and I think it sort of kept me alive, really. I mean, two of my old band are dead, and stops you becoming an alcoholic, and it stops you just, I think it keeps you level.
And you said you've got something called Voyager 2 on Spotify.
Oh, yes, yes. That's it's all dance stuff. And a lot of them feature a girl called Jess Hayes, who's someone I've known for years and years. Really good sort of session vocalist.
Oh, great. And so that's on Spotify, because I can... Right. I've created a Spotify playlist to go with the
wicked.
Podcast. So you've worked with quite a lot of female artists. Obviously, we've mentioned Kylie Minogue and Sophie Ellis-Bextor already. But you also worked with Kathy Dennis for the Rachel Stevens album. And you had a big hit with I Said Never Again. So just wanted to know how it was working with Rachel, because she had some really big songs. And whether you've got any stories behind that particular song, how that came about.
With I Said Never Again, it was a song title I had in my lyric book, and thought it'd be really cool to write something with. And I was working with two guys called Jules and Stone at the time, and threw the title at them, and they loved it. And we ended up writing the whole song together for Rachel. 19 heard the song, loved it, and put Rachel in the studio with us. She learned the song really professionally, came in and sung it really well. And I only sort of met her for 2 hours and did that tune, but she was very pro. And it was a good session.
And you also worked with another actress that was on Neighbours, Holly Valance, who then became a pop star. and you wrote the song Down Boy for her. So I just wondered if you remember how that song came about. Do you remember where the lyric idea came from and what it was like working with her?
It was a song I'd had already for a couple of years, and I just thought it would be a good pitch for Holly. And at the time, it was sent to London Records. They loved it, sent Holly down to do a demo with me. And I ended up doing a few things with Holly for her album. She was fun, really good to work with. Did a little bit of writing with her as well. One good story is when we were writing together, I took her down to my local curry house, and all the waiters went bananas because she was really high profile at the time, and we got a free meal and everything, which was cool. And Down Boy ended up going to number 2 in the charts.
So we've come to our final question, which we've also been asking all guests, which is, which song do you wish you'd written?
I think a song that I've always had in my mind was Unbreak My Heart, the Diane Warren song, because the chords are amazing, the lyrics are amazing, it's just a really good pop song.
So Diane Warren wrote it for Toni Braxton?
Yeah, she did.
So what is it about that song then that you...
I think it's the reversal of Unbreak My Heart. But if you listen to the song or you've ever played it, the chords are just brilliant. They're just like different. I mean, most chords nowadays, most songs are like 4 chords, but like it's almost changes key from verse to chorus and stuff. She was really clever like that.
Oh wow! And then that's the beauty of a song like that, that you don't notice.
There's a few amazing songs like that that happened. Yeah.
I was talking with Michelle, we were talking about ABBA being amazing at that, like writing really catchy songs, but they're actually really intricate and sophisticated musically.
What a pianist that guy, yeah, brilliant, brilliant. My other favourite band from the 70s and 80s was Steely Dan. I mean, incredible lyrics, but incredible playing as well, you know.
Do you think Mudd was very specific to like a UK London sound at the time?
Yeah, I think it's a funny old sort of period, the Mudd thing. I often tell young musicians now, in the 70s and way back then, even before we had hits, we were earning quite a good living because we'd play social clubs, universities, pubs, and there was lots of gigs, but there's no gigs now. It's like really sad for bands, you know. If a young band wants to make it, they've got to get their own following and almost pay for themselves, pay to play in the place, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So were you all based in London then?
Yeah, came from Mitcham in Surrey, South London. And we used to tour all over the country. We used to go to Sweden and all sorts of mad places. Just working up a reputation sort of thing live.
Sorry, this isn't songwriting related, but the glam rock kind of image, did you guys get told to kind of go along with it once you got signed, or were you already dressing like that?
It's a weird one. We the rest of the guys were more Teddy Boy, and then this guy at Carnaby Cabinet, the gay guy, said to me... you don't suit drain pipes, I'm going to design for you. And he made me all these mad cat suits, and everybody thought they were dresses.
Amazing. If you want to hear more of Rob's work, please check out the Spotify playlist I made for this episode. His new album Chakra Tracks is out now, and he also has releases under his dance project name Blip. If you want to hear more of my music, please follow me on Spotify, Instagram and Twitter, and please subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'd like to thank all my guests so far who I've had the pleasure of interviewing. You can catch up on all the other episodes online now if you haven't already, but also don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss out on the next series. We'd also love to hear from you, so please feel free to comment on anything you've heard. In fact, we'd love to know what surprised you the most in this series. Please let us know your thoughts. And thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it.
This podcast is produced by Unedited.